deep from the heart of Wallingford comes the savage cry of history with Cairo Radio's resident historian Felix Bunnell, who today has a story about a classic roadside landmark hiding in plain sight in downtown Seattle. Felix, of course, is brought to you by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Aaron. You're getting ready for the holiday radio play season there with your announcer
voice. Buddy, yeah, did you see what I did?
We have hints.
We have dates for October and December. I'll get those on your calendar. Okay, so that vintage Tarzan radio show opened. That will make sense in a minute or two here. You have to trust me on this one. So it is road trip season, right? And with the pandemic winding down, the desire to get out on the highway and cover some ground feels even more intense than ever. It's also the 65th anniversary this week of Congress passing and President Dwight D. Eisenhower signing the legislation that created the interstate highway system back in 1956. Now, the roadside landmark I want to talk about today is from a slightly earlier golden age of highway travel, which not many people think of as the 1930s because it was the Great Depression, but it was also a terrific era of great American roads and great American roadside architecture. Now, this odd little structure, what we're talking about today, it's in a parking lot along Denny Way at 7th Avenue in Dexter. This is just east of where the old Elephant Car Wash sign once stood. And what this roadside artifact is a little two-story octagonal kiosk made of brick. It's really a strange building, unlike anything I've seen here in town before. It kind of looks like a silo, and it still has signs on it from what it most recently was, which is a skateboard shop, right? Now, I can't remember the first time I noticed it, but I finally had some time to do research about it. And by looking at old photos from the Seattle Municipal Archives and with some help from the state architectural historian Michael Hauser, I was able to figure out that it was originally a pretty amazing gas station. Now, why would you have a gas station on Denny Way? Lots of traffic on Denny Way, right? But there's an even better reason, because that gas station officially opened on May 17th, 1933. That was also the same day that the new and improved Aurora Avenue opened. This was the connection from Denny all the way up to the bridge. And then the beyond the bridge up to 85th Street. You know, the bridge itself opened a year earlier in 1932. But that stretch between Denny Way and the bridge was like a missing link that just hadn't been there for about it. The bridge was just not there by itself. It was hard to get to. Uh-huh. And so this beautiful new highway opened up. And so 7th Avenue, which runs along the west side of that triangle-shaped lot, was actually U.S. Highway 99. This is like putting a gas station next to a freeway.
Wow.
Even though it's just sort of desolate now, that part of 7th Avenue, they built a sidewalk across it. Now you can't even get to Denny from 7th anymore. It's just like a little dead end. So the odd little triangle, it seems like a bit of a wasteland. Actually a brilliant place to open a gas station in 1933. And now, this wasn't just any old gas station, right? We wouldn't be talking about it this morning if it wasn't for the fact that the kiosk had on top of it a giant rotating neon sign, narrow and shaped like a three-sided pillar, probably 20 feet tall. It spun around three times a minute, and it had three sides. It was festooned with 300 feet of neon tubing, and spelled out vertically on the sides of the sign were the words Signal, Marine, and Union 76, because they actually sold three brands of gas, which is kind of, I don't quite get that. It's a different era. And they had nine pumps. I mean, this was like a palace of gasoline sales. And there's a big canopy that covered the pump areas. Now, the Tarzan part of this, right? The Signal brand had just come to Seattle in the spring of 1933. It started in California a decade or so earlier, and they made a big splash on the West Coast in early 1933 as they expanded into Oregon and Washington and sponsored the Tarzan radio program. And you could hear it three times a week on KJR in Seattle, by the way. So see, you could trust me when I said to bear with me to make the connection between Tarzan and a gas station. And now the print ads for Signal Gas from 1933 are over the top. They claim that Signal Gas gives the power of Tarzan, and they show Tarzan, you know, wrestling with a crocodile or about to stab a tiger. Very politically incorrect. Tarzan was like battling the animals in those days. He wasn't like the eco-warrior he eventually became. No. And so, you know, what all this says is that the dirty little secret of gasoline is that it's all the same, right? No gas gave you better mileage or was better to your car. They had to come up with the marketers had to come up with a way to convince their consumers to choose their product over somebody else's for irrational reasons, right? There wasn't like, you know, it all comes out of the ground.
Yeah, that's right.
So by sponsoring the Tarzan radio show and creating something they called the Signal Tarzan Club, they motivated kids to pester their mom or dad about which gas station to visit and which gas to buy. You know, Signal did this, but so did Richfield, which became ARCO. They had a kid-focused Jimmy Allen Flying Club that was actually based in Seattle in the 1930s. Now, that's not to say the oil companies didn't also try to appeal to adults. We have a Signal radio ad from around 1940.
Mileage is really the best yardstick of gasoline quality. That's why we're so proud of Signal's good mileage. And it's why Signal says, when you buy gasoline for your car, to be sure you're getting the tops in quality, there are just two things to remember. One, in gasoline, it takes extra quality to go farther. And two, throughout the West, from Canada to Mexico, Signal is the famous Go Farther gasoline.
Yeah, see, it lets you go farther because it's special. It's very special.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, that kind of sounded like your voice at the beginning there.
A little bit. Now, Aaron's better.
I also found the architect's name on some documents and plans that the City of Seattle Department of Construction and Inspection shared with me, a guy named George Wellington Stoddard. Now, that name didn't ring a bell for me like other local architects like Paul Theory or Victor Steinbrück might. But once I looked at his biography on the website of the Washington State Office of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, I did recognize some of the buildings that George Wellington Stoddard designed. The South Grandstand at Husky Stadium, way ahead of its time, very modern looking. The old Aqua Theater at Green Lake, part of which is still there, which was a place where Led Zeppelin played in the late 60s.
Right? Did they really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then my personal favorite, the beleaguered and much under-disappreciated Memorial Stadium at Seattle Center. That's another Stoddard piece. So, and I mentioned Michael Hauser. He's the state architectural historian. I asked him why George Wellington Stoddard is not as well known as it seems he should be.
I think he's really one of the sort of, I don't know if you want to say he's the top 10 underappreciated, you know, sort of guys that are the players, but I mean, he did stuff all over the state and certainly had a very long and prolific career. So he definitely was a player during the time and just, you know, not as well noted because nobody's really studied him in that much depth, or, you know, he didn't do grand sort of buildings, did a lot of residential properties, did a lot of schools and smaller kind of, you know, pretty cool little commercial buildings here and there.
Yeah, you know, Signal was pretty well known for some visually striking stations. There's still an old one in Portland in the St. John neighborhood that was restored, and it's now a pizza place. It's got all the neon and everything. It's a gorgeous-looking building. Now, that old Signal gas station on Denny Way probably won't be around much longer. The assessor's website says the land is worth about $2.8 million. That's a very expensive little triangle. Mm. Now, I'm not positive, but it sure seems like it'll become something besides a parking lot or a skateboard shop. In the meantime, some of the artifacts are still there, including one of the original three pump islands. There's this big concrete thing. It's just still there.
Huh.
A lot of metal hardware in the ground that looks like it probably goes to the gas tanks. And the Signal Gas brand was around into the early 60s. I couldn't figure out exactly when that Denny Way station ceased being a Signal gas station. But through permitting, it ceased officially being allowed to be a gas station in 1987, which I think was a strategic move because in 1988, the state started tracking defunct gas station tanks. So the tanks might still be there. It's not on the state's radar for having ever been examined.
Really?
So that's, you know, that's just part of the modern property issues. George Wellington Stoddard passed away in 1967. Oh, and I checked with Mohai yesterday. Restoration continues on the Elephant Car Wash sign, and there's no timeline for when it will be on display. Do we have time for a little more Tarzan? This last little, let's hear a little bit of Tarzan.
Sure.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of Tarzan.
Here we go.
The girl had sung in a low, vibrant voice. But it was not the magnetism of her song alone, but the terror in her eyes that brought Tarzan to her aid. With enemies in constant pursuit, ever threatening to still the lovely voice forever and to kill Tarzan for his interference, he manages to delay her inevitable fate as he guides her across a continent in our next story.
Okay, now I want to hear more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You've hooked Heather Bosch. Such a dramatic sting. Thank you so much, Felix.
Thanks,
that is Felix Bunnell, one of the greats. The 30th day of June, 2021. Let's get back to something that approximates normalcy on a state level, Hannah Scott reports.
Restaurants, grocery stores, and more can now return to full capacity. Neighborhoods can come back to life. Bars can stay open later and more now that Washington State has reopened. In Seattle, the reopening means Mayor Durkin and the Downtown Seattle Association's Welcome Back Weeks are just around the corner.
These are going to be 2 weeks of really great programming of arts and music and restaurant openings and retail programming, really designed to bring people back here.
Tom Norwalk with Visit Seattle says tourism is already well on its way back.
Oh, well, it's been a wonderful kind of growth over the last couple of months since mid-April. Going into the governor's announcement of reopening at the end of June, we've seen just week after week modest growth in terms of visitors coming in, hotel occupancies growing, reopenings from everywhere from museums to attractions, and even a few hotels that remain closed for a number of months have reopened. And I think now with the full reopening, we're seeing kind of the sky's the limit. We've got a lot of ground to catch up on, and it's looking really promising for the summer and fall.
But he admits there have been losses.
Really not a lot of major losses from a tourism per se, strictly tourism. But from a restaurant standpoint, from a small retail, from every other part of the industry, yeah, there's been a number of closures, as you know. I think the Downtown Seattle Association would say there's close to 400 permanent business closures around the city. And that impacts tourism greatly because that's the uniqueness of our city and our neighborhoods and that experience to be on the streets and visiting shops and having fun on the city.
And despite this full reopening, there are lingering concerns about the Delta variant.
That is a huge concern because I think part of our long-term forecast for recovery is predicated on vaccines worldwide and ability for us to handle that, for international travel to open up again, for certainly our Canadian border to get reopened later this summer. And if other countries and if that variant is really taking a toll, that could slow things down. So we're keeping an eye on that.
And Hannah Scott joins us live. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron Mason.
So what's the vibe?
It's, a little bit mixed. So I talked to several people, and so some of the bars could stay open last night as the clock struck, June 30th, basically at midnight. Those limits of, they used to have to close at midnight, and now they could stay open until 2. I saw some bars that did do that and had quite a crowd. Other bartenders that I talked to yesterday were like, we're not really in any big rush to do that. It's hot, whatever, we'll get there. and that's actually some of the people that I talked to yesterday that I ran into, a very large portion of them, probably 5 or 6 people said, I said, so what do you think about reopening tomorrow? And people said, what? They had no idea. Yeah. They were completely clueless about it. And then I did find a woman who was not vaccinated who said, she thought the whole thing was BS to begin with, and that she would not be getting a vaccine because she thought it was a government conspiracy that was serving as a test to see how many people would follow as sheep to be led into socialism. I'm paraphrasing, but mostly it was like that. But she's not alone. There are a lot of people who have not decided not to get vaccinated. That's why we're still hovering just under that 70% mark, and because they're kind of immovable, right? They all kind of sound like her.
Yep, I've definitely heard that. What are any patterns in what people are most excited about in reopening or most trepidatious over?
People are kind of trepidatious about going to gyms, to indoors, anywhere. Uh-huh. A lot of people are still wearing masks. I think we heard that from a gym owner that Cairo 7 TV was talking to this morning. He said most of his people still wear masks, even if they're vaccinated, just to be safe. And I hear that from a lot of people. See a lot of people in the grocery store still masking up. People are excited to get outside, to be with people, right? Remember, we had for a while, you couldn't be around anybody that wasn't in your household.
Yeah,
and then when you could, it was like 5 people or something like that. So, people are ready to have some sense of normalcy and just be outside. It's been hard. And I think people are now just starting to realize, you kind of take this sigh of relief and you go, oh, my gosh, what have I just been through, kind of a thing. And you have to be careful.
Well, we'll have to go grab a drink sometime, Hannah.
Definitely.
Now that we're back open. The great Hannah Scott. Thank you so much. Seattle's Morning News, I'm Aaron Mason, filling in for Dave Ross. A question for you. Has big tech gotten too big? Many people say so. In fact, there has been legislation introduced in D.C. that, and I will read from the New York Times here, the bills are the most sweeping set of antitrust legislation in generations and take aim at Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, by trying to undo their dominance in online commerce, advertising, media, and entertainment. And our guest joining us now is an antitrust expert. She is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and her research helped to shape this legislation. Her name is Stacy Mitchell, and she joins us now. Good morning, Stacy.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
So let's talk about this. I'll ask you the question, although I know the answer. Has big tech gotten too big?
Yes, it's definitely gotten too big. But I think more importantly, it's also just become too powerful. And that really is the more central question, is how much power do these companies have? And they have extraordinary power over the flow of goods, services, and information.
So what is exactly in this legislation? What are the proposals to try and curb some of this overreaching or too much power that you see?
There are a few that have to do with funding and some jurisdiction questions, but the most significant of the bills would break up the companies along business lines. Another would say that they can't use their power to preference their own products and services against those of competitors. Another would limit their ability to buy other companies, to acquire, say, small tech firms, and to, you know, engage in those kinds of mergers. And finally, there's a bill around interoperability, which would enable users to port their data from one platform to the other more mm-hmm. easily.
Well, what would you say to people who don't have a problem with, say, the process of creating a startup? Let's say it's a tech startup. You have a successful product, a good idea, and then you sell to Google for, let's say, $100 million, and then you've done a good job. Your work is done. What would you say is the issue with that?
Well, there are a few different issues. I mean, one, we've consistently seen these companies use acquisitions to augment their monopoly power. And so they buy up small companies and then either take those ideas and incorporate them into their own products, or in many cases, they simply shut down the development of those products. And so they're lost as part of that acquisition. They just get sort of merged into the company and then there's no further development. Because of the market dominance that these companies have, one of the things we've also seen is that there's a real lack of investment in startups that might either compete with these companies or even just create sort of new fields of development that could potentially be threatening to these companies at some point down the road. You know, investors are steering clear of those ideas. So, you know, for every company that maybe grows and sells to one of the big firms, there are lots of companies or ideas, I should say, entrepreneurs that never get investment in the first place. They occupy what investors have referred to as like a kill zone. That they will not invest in because of the dominance of the tech firms. So I think there's a lot to be said by saying no more acquisitions. If you want to develop a product, develop it yourself, Amazon or Google. Don't just buy up a company so that you can leapfrog into dominating yet another industry. And I would also say that in doing that, we're going to see a lot of, you know, sort of mid-size and even larger companies have more opportunities to compete. And so I don't really think that we're going to see a situation where the small startup that wants to exit isn't going to have an opportunity to do that. I think it's going to be actually be very good for the whole ecology of startups and sort of tech development in general.
So we are talking about a consumer benefit here, that it's not, you know, people hear this and they won't think, my Amazon is going to change dramatically. Is it going to have an effect on the average consumer from their perspective?
You know, I think the hard thing as a consumer is that we don't know what we're missing because all right. of that, you know, all of those new ideas aren't there. And the worry that I have is, you know, that the dominance of these companies really makes it impossible for not only like breakthrough new ideas to come along, like a totally new approach to something in the digital markets,
right.
but also just the ordinary everyday kinds of innovations, you know, the new authors, the new products and so on that struggle to find a market when you've got Amazon in various ways dominating online commerce and steering people to its own products and services.
Getting back to the legislation in D.C., it's something that the bills were co-sponsored by our own Pramila Jayapal from Washington State here. She said that the lobbying, and I'll get to this in a second, is making our case that they have way too much power in terms of monopoly and in terms of money and politics. And how can small businesses and consumers hope to compete with just this incredible amount of power and money? How did these tech companies respond to this proposed legislation?
Boy, they went to great lengths. I mean, just the massive lobbying push, you know, after these bills were introduced and the lead up to the markup and the vote on them was just intense. I mean, what I you know, heard from congressional staff was that their inboxes were being flooded. I mean, they were getting calls. It was a sort of all out push to block this legislation, and a lot of like scare tactics and sort of misleading scenarios
sure.
being thrown around about what this legislation would do. I mean, it really was an illustration of the kind of political power that these companies have.
How do you see the next several steps. Where are we today, and what's sort of in the near future?
This is a big moment. I mean, Congress is finally facing these issues like square on, facing both the outsized power of big tech, but also the failures of antitrust policy. And so that's extremely encouraging. The legislation was bipartisan. There are Republicans on all of these bills, including the breakup bill. That's also very encouraging. And there's just growing momentum on this issue. I think it's become clear to most Americans and to lots of different segments of society that if we don't deal with the power of big tech, it's going to undermine the overall health and vitality of our economy, our ability to have good middle-class jobs, and ultimately our system of democracy. I mean, when you have companies that have this extraordinary level of power, you know, not only do they overwhelm government, but, you know, ultimately these companies are kind of, you know, they're regulating our markets. They're deciding who wins and you know, who succeeds and who fails in our online markets because of the kind of gatekeeping power that they have. And that reckoning between their power and democracy is going to happen one way or another, and hopefully sooner rather than later.
That is Stacy Mitchell. She is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Thank you so much for joining us, Stacy.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. When learning went remote a year ago, many kids were left behind without consistent access to a computer. CBS's Vladimir Dutier has more on how one determined mom is making a difference by working to bridge that digital divide.
Tanisha Grant is closing Harlem's digital divide for school children one computer at a time.
This is for you, Mama.
Her group, Parents Supporting Parents NYC, has helped raise money to get new laptops into the hands of children lacking the essentials for remote learning.
Thank you so much.
If you can complain about it, you can get up and do something about it.
And that's what this activist and mother of three did.
I was one of them little black babies that was told that I only deserved hand-me-downs.
She's a future leader.
Grant has helped give away more than 100 laptops since the school year began. On this day, she gave 23 laptops to kids like 8-year-old Catalia.
I guess you're Zooming me on your brand new laptop, right?
Yeah. I felt like I was the only one that didn't have one. I felt sad, but with this new laptop, I feel so happy and I feel special.
Special, all because of a woman bridging the divide between access and knowledge.
I just want my babies to know they could be wherever they want to be.
Vladimir Dutier, CBS News, New York.
After seeing the story, HP is donating 350 laptops plus printers and other supplies to students in Harlem. How great is that?
First of all, I love that lady.
Yes.
She sounds amazing.
And the kids. Oh,
and
my
those
gosh.
Those sweet kids. I'll tell you, Heather, I really do believe that people rise to the level that you treat them at.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
And if you tell someone you can achieve, you mm-hmm. can do this, and especially kids, you help them get along that path, I have full faith that that really, really can change lives.
Absolutely.
Super fun. Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason, and for Dave Ross, here with Heather Bosch, and from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays, 9 to noon,
it's
here
open.
On Cairo Radio.
It's open!
Scott, you know that voice. What's up, G?
It's open. Good morning.
Good morning. Ooh, you're peppy today.
Well, you know, it's open.
That's right.
State of Washington.
G's in studio.
Mm-hmm.
It's open. The state is open.
Yeah.
Living that new life. You turning that page, bud?
Yeah. I had to come in studio because of today. Today's the day that it's open. And plus, Ursula loves it when I come in studio.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I just thought I'd come in. What are we talking about today, bro?
All right. Look, I know there's this lingering bitterness over the loss of the Sonics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know it turned some people in the area off from the NBA altogether. You know, the basketball the bitter basketball boycotters.
Totally understand.
We can call them. Mm-hmm. What's up with the NBA right now? Is it worth paying attention to? The playoffs are going on?
It's the greatest that it's ever been, ever.
Really?
Hold on. That's a bold statement.
The NBA talent is incredible. I won't even just stay and stop with the NBA. I'm going to say college talent. I'm going to say high school talent. Mm. I'm going to say middle school talent. And those listening right now, you probably have gone to see your niece, your nephew play, your son or your daughter play. You've seen it. You've seen how much better the basketball talent is today. When I played college basketball.
Yeah.
I don't know if many people know that. Uh-huh. I am barely 6'1", right?
Uh-huh.
Today, 6'1"? What? In college? Yeah. What? You know what I mean? And so what you are seeing now, you are seeing the likes of a bunch of kids that are shoot the ball special. Steph Curry coming to the game made kids really have the confidence to even want to shoot. Back in the day when I was coming up, if you shot a three-pointer and you missed it, your coach told you don't shoot it anymore.
Right. Well,
today, you have kids that are shooting. So I'm bringing that point up so I can set the stage to help you guys understand the NBA game. Mm-hmm. Is special. There's so much talent. Of course, you know who LeBron is.
Right.
You know who Kevin Durant is.
Right.
I know that's a sore topic because Kevin Durant was drafted here in 2007 by the Sonics. But there's so much talent. And the crazy thing is this postseason, there has been so many injuries, right? Mm. And here's the weird thing. Yes, that's bad. But then you see another player step up.
Yeah.
And so now all of these new players are coming, and you're like, whoa. So we've been spending a lot of time watching, me and some friends, watching a lot of the NBA. And I know here in Seattle there are some people saying, I'm still not watching. That's fine. I totally understand.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's going to be a lot of people not watching until a team comes back. But if you're an NBA fan, you want to watch.
I got to ask you, though, are the teams, is that talent spread throughout? Because occasionally you'll get, oh, this team is always good or that team is always good. Don't even bother watching this other team. What do you think?
Great question on that. That's what you're getting right now. So for an example, the teams that are still in it right now, nobody predicted the Phoenix Suns would be in the Western Conference Finals, right? The Clippers, yeah, maybe. They have been playing good basketball. But this is going to be another sore topic, and I apologize. But Nate McMillan, former Seattle Sonic, the great Nate McMillan, who's a great career, we know who he is, he took over a struggling Atlanta Hawks team in March. The team was 14-20. Nobody was writing this team off. This team is balling right now in the Eastern Conference Finals, and they just won last night to tie the series up, and they're going back home. There might be a possibility that the Atlanta Hawks might go to the finals. Let me ask you this. When's the last time you heard of the Milwaukee Bucks going to the finals?
A while ago.
So there's so much parity, if you will.
Yeah, like, right.
And we're getting to the NBA. Hear me out. Is getting closer to the NFL.
Hmm.
The NFL is more of, you almost never know who's going to win it.
Right.
Well, that's where the NBA is heading towards. So for so many years, it was like, okay, it's going to be kind of like the same four teams.
Right.
That's kind of changing, Heather, and that's a great question. And that's why I think that this year, I think there's going to be a big deal with a lot of people coming back to NBA.
Okay, I'm going to have to watch. Yeah. I'm going to have to watch.
Quick question. Yeah. Do you think we're going to get a team once that arena opens?
Ouch.
Yes.
Yeah? You ready?
Absolutely. Are you kidding me? Who? Yes. And this ain't, wait, this isn't about feelings.
Uh-huh.
This is about money, baby.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong. What does Seattle have? Money.
Bezos bought the arena.
Oh, man.
That climate change arena.
I mean, come on. There's a lot of money here. But, it's open, right?
Yeah.
Everything's open. You guys changing? You got any new habits? You got any new restaurants? What you doing?
Yeah, less mask. I mean, it's so nice that it's hot out, you know, and those masks were starting to get to me.
It was a bit much when it was 108.
Yeah. So it'll be nice to have that off a little more often than usual, but there are still places. If I'm around a bunch of people, you know, supermarket or trans, you know, if I'm on the bus or whatever, definitely.
Random question. When you sweat in your mask, well, what do you do with it after? Because, bro, I sweated in my mask the other day. I was going to the store on Monday, had to go to Costco. Sweated in the mask. I mean, I just threw that thing away.
Yeah. It was bad, dude. It was bad.
Man, who sweats in the mouth?
A pile of dirty mask.
Like, bro, you sweating in the mouth?
That's a new thing for me. I didn't even know I had sweat there. All right, everybody. G. Scott, the great. He'll be on with Ursula right after our show here at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio.
Seattle's next mayor will have a lot of big issues to tackle, including the spike in gun violence that the city is dealing with. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott sat in on a forum on that issue with the top candidates.
It's not a new problem for Seattle. It's one that a long line of mayors have had to grapple with, but perhaps not quite as severe as we're seeing right now. The King County Prosecutor's Office says as of 1 week ago, there have been 68 murder or likely murder calls, most of those involving guns. That's one shy of the 69 there were for all of 2016, and comes as we start the summer, when shootings typically go way up. How would the top candidates for Seattle mayor address gun violence? Well, they were grilled on that yesterday, including the question on what they would do to address gun violence if they had a magic wand. From candidate Colleen Echohawk.
If I had that magic wand, I would just get rid of all guns in this city and in this country. Remove them from this place, from this world. We don't need guns in this world.
Andrew Grant Houston had this to offer.
If I could wave a magic wand, what I would really focus on is ensuring that at the end of the day, every single person in our communities would be able to go home to an affordable place that they're not worried about losing and that there would be food on the table.
Former state lawmaker Justin Farrell is also a top mayoral candidate.
If I could wave a wand and as mayor, not waving wands, but using public policy and the tools of government and politics, I believe that we need to be treating the gun violence epidemic the same way we've treated the COVID-19 pandemic, which means to take all of our community resources for all of us to get off the sidelines, no matter what part of the city that you live in, and to join in this effort to get to zero gun violence.
And former city council president Bruce Harrell.
I had that magic wand. I would remove from human beings that impulse to take a life, to kill. You know, the use of guns is symptomatic of a human being who lacks an appreciation, a love for life to be able to take a life. And so I would remove that. But because I don't have a magic wand, I would also work vehemently to remove RCW 941290, which is the state exemption law, to allow local jurisdictions the flexibility, the power, the authority to regulate and impose reasonable gun safety laws.
While current council president Lorena Gonzalez had this to say.
If I had a magic wand, I would dismantle the insidious NRA and I would abolish all firearms in our city and in our state.
There was a flash round where they were just holding up thumbs up or thumbs down on multiple questions from the moderator. The candidates were asked about whether they would support expanding investments into community programs such as Choose 180 and community passageways, and all said yes. Those programs interrupt gun violence or aim to, and prevent young people from getting their hands on guns in the first place, or if they do, help them once that happens. And they've long been fighting to be scaled up. Other ideas that were pushed hard were making sure that those communities where gun violence happens are accountable, from everything from talking to police to being present as parents or adult in the area of these young people who would get guns.
And now Hannah Scott joins us live. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron.
Was there anything that surprised you from any of these candidates?
Not, it's tough. I've been covering this issue a long time, so mm-hmm. I don't generally get overly surprised on this. There's some good ideas, though. I'm a particular fan of the investments into those community programs like Choose 180 and Community Passageways. They do great work. They just don't get to do enough of it. And that's really about the prevention side, right? They really focus in on trying to interrupt that path towards getting into a gang as a young person or something along those lines.
Hannah, how do they do that?
I actually got to go and meet with Sean Good, who heads up the Choose 180 group. They're people who have lived experience, right? They are people who grew up in these types of communities, were around gang violence as kids, so they can kind of speak the same language as these kids, which really is vitally important when you're doing that. It's a trust issue, right?
Right.
If you've not been there where they've been, then they're not going to listen to you.
Right.
So he has that. When a kid is, say, busted for having possession of a firearm, hasn't necessarily shot anyone or anything like that, they have these basically workshops is what they get sentenced to. They get diverted away from the law enforcement side and they go to these workshops mm-hmm. with Sean where they hand out beads and they share stories with others who've been through it. And it kind of gives them a sense of community and belonging. And it's a very interesting program that he has over at Community Passageways. You get mentorship. You get hope. I think the biggest and most important message when you're talking about keeping kids away from guns, especially when we're talking about gang violence, is you're talking about people who are dealing with poverty and
right.
one parent. Or I met one kid one time who had he had a gun because there were older people in his community that were gang members that had a gun. It was just him and his mom and his little brother.
Right.
He felt that he needed to protect his family. So how you get in there and you offer them hope on how not to make that choice and where to get other help. And then also you need to, you know, have community programs and interact as a community with policing. It's something Seattle used to do a long time ago, but they don't now. So if you can get all those groups working together, it can be a solution.
In the time that you've been covering this issue, has there been any evolution? Is there any sort of change in the general discussion that you've noticed?
I think from the time that I landed in Seattle back in 2010 to now, that mostly what I just described about these prevention programs
uh-huh.
and those have been the biggest shifts. Now we talk, and again, community policing. You hear the same stuff. We need to end the state preemption, which that's the law that's on our state books that prevents local jurisdictions from enacting their own tougher gun laws than what is state law. Seattle has long tried to do that. It did get through their safe storage law. That's the biggest thing that I've heard forever mm-hmm. in the state. The same things like the community programs are the newest thing. And really, there's some candidates now that are talking about working with police, which you don't hear a lot of these days. A lot of the candidates talked about defunding police to invest in those community programs I was talking about. But one candidate we had is Lance Randall. I'm not terribly familiar with him, but I know that he was shot at, nearly shot, just last week, I believe it was, happened. It was in a neighborhood where somebody shot at him who was trying to steal something. I forget the specifics, but he ducked down behind a car and the bullet hole went right through the window. He wants to develop a relationship-based policing program that could lead to what he called a community policing philosophy. So have lots of town halls where you have people in the neighborhood who meet with police on a regular basis to try to improve that trust and then have everyone work together. And I think that too is a good idea. You've got to get the collective to work on this and you have to have those communities be present. But I want to point out that doesn't address the entirety of the gun issue. You
sure.
still have kids who get a hold of guns in the home, who, you know, maybe go and have a mass shooting or who take their own lives. That's a whole nother issue that's very, very bad in our state.
Hannah, we have another minute. Is there any, have you talked to anyone in law enforcement about this? Because the relationship between law enforcement and the mayor is important and occasionally contentious. Do you know what the feelings of the law enforcement side is right now?
The feeling of law enforcement in general when we're talking about Seattle police is I think worn out,
yeah.
waiting to see what's going to happen. Many of them have left, as we know. And now remember, we've got a police chief who is under title an interim police chief. So they when Carmen Best left, we have Adrian Diaz, who was put in place. Whether he remains as the Seattle police chief, we won't know until there's a mayor. So I think you're going to see a struggle. The contract for the police is up again. They're going to try sometime here in the future to negotiate a new contract. That's going to be very contentious. And I don't know. That's a lot for the new mayor to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So law enforcement, there's not a lot of trust between city council, mayor, and the Seattle Police Department as it is.
Yeah, a little bit of a dysfunctional family there.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Hannah, the great Hannah Scott.
My pleasure. You can ring my bell.
Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason filling in for Dave Ross. It's time for Ring My Bell, brought to you by Chevrolet Buick GMC of Puyallup. Good morning, Rachel Bell.
Good morning, Aaron.
How are you?
I'm doing good. It's cooler in my home today. I think that we can all function. Our brains aren't melted any longer.
Did you have as hard a time thinking as I did?
You know what? I think I might have mentioned this yesterday, but I'm one of those jerks who has air conditioning at home. So I don't think I'm suffering quite as much as other people. But I think that I was, what do you call it? Like, I feel like I was feeling for other people because I did feel foggy yesterday. And I don't know why. I was having like...
sympathy brain fog.
Thank you. Yep, that's what it's called. I'm having it right now. That's why I can't remember the word.
See?
So today we're talking about this concept of death doulas. There is an article in the New York Times talking about this. The story starts with this mother who lost her 33-year-old daughter who had spent her life with cystic fibrosis. And after her daughter died, like most people, she felt very lost and she didn't really understand what to do with her grief. And she decided she wanted to help other people with that. So she signed up for this certificate program at the University of Vermont's Larner College of Medicine to become an end-of-life doula. And from what I'm reading, I think this is the only school in the country that is offering this kind of certificate. So she said, in our culture, we go overboard preparing for birth, but hope for the best at the end of life. The training was really a way to get even deeper into my own grief and realizing how I could take my own experience and help other people have a better end of life. You know, where hospice, there is a medical element to it. Since this is like an 8-week long program, doulas, just like a birth doula, don't get into the medical stuff. They are strictly there for support for the person who is at the end of life. What they said in the article was they support clients emotionally, physically, spiritually, and practically, stepping in whenever needed. So they said it could be a few days before someone dies, giving them hand massages, giving them snacks. It could be months or even years earlier when someone receives a terminal diagnosis to give them company and to listen to them and to help them plan their own funeral or craft an autobiography. And they said 1,400 people have graduated from this program since it was started in 2017. It's only $800 for 8 weeks. And some of the things that you do as a student in this program is writing farewell letters to loved ones, crafting your own obituary, completing legacy work or what they call a life story project, and then, you know, starting or updating your own advanced care planning files. And something that was interesting here, it said that they've actually had an uptick in people during COVID because a lot of people lost their jobs. So they said there's been a lot of artists, actors, young people, and restaurant workers. And they said a lot more young people than usually get into the business of hospice or elderly care because they were seeing people their own age dying during the pandemic and became more aware of death, which sounds like a silly thing. But, you know, when you're young, you don't really think about it much.
Of course.
And so there's a lot more people now who want to help others at the end of their life.
Yeah, I have a little bit of experience with hospice. I've lost three grandparents, and the first one I lost, I was around quite a bit for, and was floored. I call them angels on earth, people who do end of life care, and you know, dealing with that kind of thing all by yourself can be completely overwhelming. And it's just, I think, a tremendous idea.
Well, I think it makes sense to have somebody who isn't in your family or a close friend, just like having a therapist who can, you know, give you advice on your life without having an opinion or an invested interest. You know, death is really, really hard for the people around the person dying. And so I'm sure that for a lot of people who know they're going to die, it might be really hard to talk. I mean, I'm sure many people do, but like having to talk to their children or their parents, it's so hard for those people that you get this kind of neutral person who you can talk to, who you can say anything to. You could say your fears, which you might not actually want to put on. You know, let's say it's a parent. I'm sure there's a lot of things you wouldn't want to tell your kids about your experience or what you're afraid about going into death.
And I wonder how many of the people who do this work have gone through a similar thing themselves, because you, as you mentioned, there's grief processing on both sides, that doing this work helps the doula to continually process the grief that they're going through. Grief doesn't go away.
No.
You know, it stays with you. You just have to sort of build up around it and figure out how to carry that with you in a healthy way. And so to get into this kind of work really, really strikes me as beneficial to both sides, right?
Yeah, and yeah, I like that you said that since I discovered Nora McInerney, who you and I both know because she was a guest on my podcast, Your Last Meal, she has become sort of a death expert. She has a podcast called Terrible Thanks for Asking, where she talks a lot about death and tragedy because she had that in her own life. And, you know, people say the wrong thing a lot when you lose somebody, and not on purpose, they're doing their best. But, you know, I think one of the things people tend to think is like, when are they going to be over the grief? And sometimes there's this pressure of like, oh, your husband died, when are you going to start dating again? You know, right. It's been 5 years. And what Nora talks about is just that, you know, you will have the grief for the rest of your life. And that doesn't mean your life doesn't go on. Yeah. But the idea that you have to wrap it up is a lot of pressure and not fair. And I don't think it, you know, people who lose someone, they miss them and love them forever.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Rach. Good talking to you.
I'll chat with you tomorrow.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.